everyone. Welcome back to the Well Depends podcast. I'm your host, Derek Doyle, and this is Andrew Barron. Today's episode is being recorded on April 16th, 2026.
The information in this episode is current as of the date recorded and is not intended as financial, tax, or legal advice. You should consult your tax, financial, and/or legal advisors before implementing any transactions and/or strategies concerning your finances.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about tax planning. No better time to do it after tax day, which was yesterday, April 15th. We have a new bill that got passed last year, and there are some new things to prepare for going forward, and also some changes that we need to be aware of from last year to this year. Let's first start with, what are the things to be aware of? Andrew, could you explain to our audience some of the key things that changed from last year to this year? And on top of that, some things to be kind of maybe aware of heading into 2026 as we start planning for this tax year.
Well, the big change that I want to point out that affects a lot of taxpayers is the $1,000 charitable contribution that people using the standard deduction can take advantage of beginning in tax year 2026. Even though the tax code did change last year, this did not go into effect until this year, 2026. So even with the higher standard deduction, or especially for seniors with the extra senior bonus deduction, a lot of people have been unable to take advantage of itemized taxes. So for people that taking standardized deduction, this is an extra benefit to encourage charitable deductions.
Yes, itemized deduction. Last year, 2025 tax year, and this year moving forward until 2029, we have the ability to take advantage of what is called a SALT, or state and local tax deduction. Could you put that in plain English to the audience, Andrew? What is the SALT itemized deduction and how that could be used when preparing your taxes?
So SALT is an acronym for state and local tax. And what that means is, if you have state tax or some municipalities like New York City also administer a tax. So it's state taxes, including property taxes and income taxes. So you aggregate all of that, and if you can itemize up to $40,000 for a couple, you can take advantage of that. So it's very beneficial for especially high tax states like New York.
Yeah. And we mentioned the senior bonus deduction, and not to get confused with the already present 65 plus deduction. This is an additional deduction on top of the one that you might have been used to already seeing and taking advantage of. This is an additional deduction that is available up to $6,000 per person. So a married filing joint couple could be eligible up to $12,000, and there are income phase outs, so we can still take a partial deduction. But I think this also is a good thing to take a look at, where someone who is 65 and older, it's going to be very difficult to become an itemized deduction person eligible with all these new standard deductions that are on top of that. It has gotten increasingly difficult to do.
Well, it probably depends on what you have going on and what you're spending on. So itemized deductions are mostly things like we said, SALT, so state and local property taxes, things like that, up to $40,000, but also the interest on mortgages. Mm-hmm. If you own your home, so you're older, that probably doesn't apply to you. But if you're younger, starting out, especially if you bought post-COVID with the 5, 6, 7% mortgage rates, you are likely to itemize just from that.
Yep.
On the other side would be if you have a major health issue, which does tend to happen as we age, that is subject to certain AGI thresholds, which is adjusted gross income. So the government assumes you are going to absorb some of that cost for your health care. But if you have major, major medical, you can itemize that as well.
And then the last two ones that are important to pay attention to going into this year and could have been taken advantage of last year is no tax on tips and then no tax on overtime. So just a quick overview, no tax on tips. It is a $25,000 deduction, and that is not per person as you might assume it would be, it's per tax return. So that's something that you might want to be taking a look at throughout the year. If you are a couple and both have tips, you might want to be tracking that because you don't have the ability to both use 25 for yourself and 25 for your spouse. And for overtime, it is $12,500 for a single and then $25,000 for married filing joint. And this is something that we want to take a look at when it comes to your W-2. There will be a new box where an employer is actually boxing out and putting in the qualified overtime. And it is just for your own mental note as well. It is only the overtime portion, meaning if you are getting paid time and a half, it's only the half that is going to be eligible for the qualified overtime. So those are just some things for you guys to be aware of as we're heading into the new tax year. One of the things that both you and I, after making it through tax season, dealt a lot with is investment performance and what that means in terms of inside of your taxable brokerage account when it comes to tax time. There's a saying out there where it says, don't let the tax tail wag the dog. Could you put that in a perspective in terms of a tax planning perspective for the audience on what that means and why it's important to maybe take investment gains, even if it does incur a tax liability?
Well, just in general, for all investments, it's important to have a strategy, whether you're short-term, long-term, hedging, very speculative, income-driven, whatever it is, you should have some sort of strategy and discipline with that. And one of that would be price targets for selling. And it's very easy to get caught up in the moment when times are good to let's just let this ride. But I like to say that the stock market takes the stairs up and the elevator down. And what that means is that, yes, we can see steady inclines for a long, long time. And I think 7 out of 8 years historically, we see an up year. So that does give us confidence in general, the stock market is moving up. But as we saw with recent war events and all of that, stock market can also rapidly decline. So taking profits when times are good is a very key to being a successful investor. I think a lot of people get caught up in the all or nothing mentality where, especially with their winners, that, oh, even though it's up, I don't want to sell out in case it doubles again or something.
Yeah.
And that's really a flawed mentality, in my opinion. I think selling 10%, 25%, 50%, something, taking some gains off the table and repositioning them ultimately makes you successful in a better position.
No, and I think this is a good topic to bring up, especially with where we're at now in the markets. We had an all-time high yesterday of April 15th where the S&P crossed 7,000. Investment performance over the last 5 years has been incredibly strong. And I think inherently people hear the word capital gains tax and think it's a bad thing, but capital gains is a symptom of a strong performing market. And we shouldn't let a tax bill scare us from making a bad investment decision. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where the saying comes from, don't let the tax tail wag the dog. We should not be making bad investment decisions because of a tax bill. There are some ways to avoid that tax bill. Could you give maybe the audience maybe one or two examples of a charitable gifting strategy that could maybe reduce or eliminate a capital gains tax totally, the appreciation of some of these assets?
Well, so if we're talking about charitable giving, donor advised funds have caught on a lot of attention recently. So that's a popular strategy where you're able to donate highly appreciated stock to something called donor advised fund, and then you can control the distributions in separate tax years. So even though we may take a large contribution this year, we often hear it called grouping or clustered contributions, where we get money into a donor advised fund, and then we can contribute it evenly or as we see fit in future years. So that's a good way to take money and get a benefit from it where you don't pay taxes on it. Mm-hmm. If you're not just trying to get money to charities, you can also consider gifting to the next generation. Typically, we think of our kids as being in a lower income bracket unless they're incredibly successful. So typically, we assume that we accumulate more money as we get older. So your younger children are in lower tax brackets, gifting them money so they can pay taxes can be a tax savings and efficiency as well.
Yeah. And kind of the, tie that point back with the donor advised funds and these different gifting strategies. Now that, like we mentioned, with the itemized deductions, kind of opening a new possibility for some of these people that live in high tax states like California, New York, New Jersey, you really could itemize a lot of things now, given the fact that you can itemize up to $40,000 in state and local property taxes. And if you have a big charitable expense, you really could push that itemized number to a pretty high amount, given the fact that there's a lot of new things in this bill that allow you to do so. So I think just bringing it all together shows you that tax planning, there are a lot of moving parts, but you really can, if you line it up correctly, can really move the needle one way or the other.
Although I want to take this minute to, let's clarify that we are talking about deductions, not credits.
Yes.
I think a lot of times people get hooked on getting a dollar for dollar benefit for gifting charity, and that just simply isn't true. Mm-hmm. You're just able to reduce your taxable income. And if, yeah, if you're in a high tax bracket, 35, 37, it can be significant. If you're in a low tax bracket, 12, you're not going to see the same benefit as someone in a higher income bracket.
Yeah. So all good points and things that we just need to be aware of when we're tax planning. That kind of rolls into how different income is taxed. And I think this is something important to realize as some of our retired or entering retired stages of life are aware of. Everything has a different bucket in which it is taxed in. You have your traditional IRAs, you have your Roth accounts, and you have your taxable brokerage accounts. And then you also have your ordinary income, which could be a wage, pension, and then you have Social Security. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people sometimes focus too much on how much they saved and not enough on where they're saving it, because I think tax diversification could be just as important as investment diversification when it comes to later on stages in life. Kind of break down to the audience how you might take advantage of these three different buckets and how that kind of works in a tax planning scheme.
Well, let's just zoom out a little bit and talk about how taxes work in general. Mm-hmm. So I think lots of times people think that, oh, I earned this and my spouse earned this, so we each have our own tax liability. But that's not how taxes are calculated. They're taxed, you're taxed and considered a household. Mm-hmm. So we look at the aggregate, what the total amount of income into the household is, and that determines a bunch of other pieces. So trying to look at each piece individually is a misconception of taxes just in general. So let's just start with that. But right, wages is ordinary income, and we consider that kind of the baseline where we're going to have a like base of income. Then we add in everything else, whether it's IRAs, which are also taxed at ordinary income because you got the tax deferral for all those years. Similar to pensions, unless there's some kind of special exclusion. And then there's capital gains. Capital gains, if they're short-term, are also taxed at ordinary income. But if you've held it for longer than a year, you get the preferential long-term capital gains tax treatment. And even though in the industry, we're very guilty of talking about the 15% bracket, 20% bracket for capital gains, similar to ordinary income, there's a 0% bracket, and you fill each of those brackets. Right. And once again, not all of your income is subject to any one of these. It's subject to all of them in a blend, depending on the total makeup of your income.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very distinct to point out that when it comes to taxes, especially if you are married, we are looking at things as a household and less on the individual side. We have been talking a lot about capital gains, and there are some things as, you know, advisors and planning through taxes throughout the year that a lot of normal everyday people are not aware of. One of those are estimated payments and the difference between that and withholding. So a lot of people assume that taxes are dealt with in April, and that's the only time you have to worry about doing taxes. And that is not true. The government wants money throughout the entire year. April is just your last day to pay them what the difference is between what you've been paying all year and what you're actually owed. We mentioned capital gains a lot, and even people who are still working and collecting a wage where there is built-in withholding, you still might need to make an estimated payment throughout the year, given the fact that you have a high capital gains year. Explain to someone in kind of layman's terms why an estimated payment might be needed due to some rules like safe harbor or the different things regarding the tax liability piece on that side.
So the government requires you to pay a percentage of your income consistently all year long, right? As you were saying, we can do that two real ways, estimated payments or withholding from typically wages or IRAs or something like that. Mm-hmm. Withholding, because you never see the money, there's something in the tax doctrine called constructive receipt. And since you never received it, you never had the ability as a taxpayer to ever spend this money, the government is okay with you not being able to spend it on something else. And if they collect it at the end of the year, that satisfies your tax liability. So you'll see us oftentimes do withholding from IRAs at the end of the mm-hmm. year to satisfy safe harbor, which is a tax threshold that as long as you're within a certain percentage of last year, depending on income, that there's no additional penalties for the current tax year. But right, capital gains don't work like that, or interest in a bank account doesn't work like that. And that is considered income for mm-hmm. tax reasons. And if you have a significant interest in taxes or capital gains, the government wants you to pay on that.
Yeah.
So making those estimated payments can be a way to satisfy these additional income taxes that you owe.
Yeah.
It's okay to owe at the end of the year. Once again, if you're within safe harbor, as long as you just make a mental note, I have a large tax bill in April, but a lot of people get caught off guard, or it's just psychologically easier to break it up into four payments rather than one large one.
Yeah. And it's not like these underpayment penalties are steep. It's just they could be easily avoided, where the safe harbor rules are essentially the IRS saying, if you pay us this amount for the current tax year, you are safe, even if you owe. So we just have those safe harbor rules that we have to meet. And even if we do have a liability at the end of the year, as long as we're in the safe harbor thresholds, we're okay. So those are some common misconceptions and some things that we want to be paying attention to throughout the tax year, given the fact that we want to be avoiding these underpayment penalties. Even if they are steep, they are easily avoidable. Kind of our last conversation that kind of gets thrown into the tax piece and usually gets brought up a lot of times towards the end of the year is Roth conversions. They are very powerful tools, but once again, they are subject to everyone's each individual case scenario. And what I mean by that is that it's usually not an all or nothing approach. And it usually has to do with certain people. And like we were talking about before, tax diversification in terms of the buckets. Traditionally, most people have a lot of their income tied up in tax deferred accounts, your 401ks, your traditional IRAs. And typically, but not always the case, typically, once we stop working, our tax brackets tend to come down, because this is supposed to be usually some of the times that we're making not as much money as we were maybe during our prime earning years. This is opportunities for us to go in and take a look to see if it makes sense to start moving pre-tax dollars into tax dollars and put it into a Roth account. What are some common misconceptions or maybe some things that the average person could be looking out for that might make sense for them to start looking into a Roth conversion as a possible strategy as they enter a near retirement?
Well, we don't have a crystal ball, so it's impossible to really know what future tax rates look like. I think Roth conversions get a lot of press in the news that lots of people should be doing them. But if we look at what the impact costs you up front versus what we could grow that money to, mm-hmm. it's significant for a lot of people. Even if you're in the 22-24% bracket, if you're in a state like New York and there's additional state tax, you could be looking at close to a 30% tax impact just to get the money into the other account. Mm-hmm. And as we know, it actually takes more than 30% just to get back to baseline. Mm-hmm. So if we were to have, you know, 30 plus percent performance, where would the other dollars be and how large would it have grown? And does that affect anything? Yes, there is the tax drag when the money comes out. And maybe you have successful children in the high tax brackets and you're considering that impact. But even with the 10-year rule, you're able to draw it out strategically as you see fit for yourself, and you get the deferral throughout the 10 years where that can still make it more sense to keep it in that pre-tax account.
Yeah.
So to answer your actual question, when does it make sense? I see it making sense if you see volatility in your income and you have a one-off, two-off, three-off set of years where your income is significantly lower than other times, where there is going to be savings for you likely in your own lifetime, where you're typically in the 22% and you have a low income year of 12%. Mm-hmm. We're converting at a much lower rate, and in, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years, we'll be back in those 20% brackets. You have now cost savings for yourself. A lot of people get hooked on trying to optimize for the next generation, which can be really impossible to predict.
Yeah. And I think Roth, like you said, it's a very hard, it's never just a yes or no question to just answer, but general rule of thumb, Roths are very good for people younger who maybe are not in their highest tax bracket yet, meaning you're still single, you're maybe only making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. This might make sense to start putting some money into some Roth accounts, given the fact that you probably are at the lower end of your probably total tax bracket earning years. And it makes sense where it's like you don't really need that tax deduction. It doesn't really help you move the needle as much. Whereas if you were in a high tax bracket, maybe you do want to be taking advantage of more deductions and reducing your overall taxable income. Mm-hmm. So I think the younger generation, it makes sense to be focusing on putting a lot of money into the Roth account. And then, like you said, for the people who are a little older, it really does come into where we kind of look at it as the filling the bucket strategy, where it's like, it's not all or nothing. Most Roth conversions, you can tell if they were done right or wrong because it's never an even number. If you converted $50,000 evenly, it's probably wrong because that's not how tax buckets work. So it is a strategy that it is sometimes you're maybe only converting 8,000, 10,000 small amounts each year and just filling up the bracket until you hit, whether it's the 32 and you don't want to go over, whatever the case is. So these are all things to keep in the back of your pocket as we're walking through tax year 2026, and some things to be aware of due to the fact that this is the true full calendar year of a lot of these new tax provisions that got passed last year. Anything else before we wrap up to the audience that you might want to have them keep in mind throughout the year when it comes to tax planning or just filing your taxes in general?
I think you already said it, but just to reiterate, it's that tax planning is done all year long. Mm-hmm. It isn't just I file my taxes in April and I don't have to worry about it for 12 months.
Yeah.
It's important to consider your tax liability to manage your whole portfolio so you're doing things optimally.
Well, thank you guys for tuning in. This was the Well, It Depends podcast, and I'm your host, Derek Doyle.
And I'm Andrew Barron.
And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for watching. If you found this video helpful, give it a thumbs up and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss future updates. Looking for more insights like this? Head over to our website at jgua.com for additional resources. And if you'd like to talk about your personal financial goals, we'd love to help. Just click the Schedule a Meeting button highlighted on your screen to book your complimentary consultation. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you in the next video.